such a lovely lady to be a liar. And then she asked me what I might design if I did not have such constraints as gravity to concern myself with. That was the beginning of the carousel, but I imagine you knew that already.
I assumed as much, Marco says, though I was not certain to what degree you were knowingly involved.
I am in a position to be quite useful as I see it. I believe stage magicians employ engineers to make their tricks appear to be something they are not. In this case, I provide the opposite service, helping actual magic appear to be clever construction. Miss Bowen refers to it as grounding, making the unbelievable believable.
Did she have anything to do with the Stargazer? Marco asks.
No, the Stargazer is purely mechanical, Mr. Barris says. I can show you the structural plans if I can locate them in this mess. It was inspired by a trip to the Columbian Exposition in Chicago earlier this year. Miss Bowen insisted there was no way to improve it, though I think she may have something to do with keeping it running properly.
Then you are a magician in your own right, sir, Marco says.
Perhaps we simply do similar things in different ways, Mr. Barris says. I had thought, knowing Miss Bowen had an opponent lurking somewhere, that whomever you might be, you were not in need of any assistance. The paper animals are astonishing, for example.
Thank you, Marco says. I have improvised quite a bit trying to come up with tents that did not require blueprints.
Is that why you're here? Mr. Barris asks. For something of the blueprint variety?
Primarily, I wanted to be certain about your awareness of the game, Marco says. I could make you forget this entire conversation, you know.
Oh, there is no need for such precaution, Mr. Barris says with a vehement shake of his head. I assure you I am capable of remaining neutral. I am not fond of taking sides. I will assist either you or Miss Bowen as much or as little as you would each prefer, and I shall reveal nothing to the other that you or she tell me in confidence. I will not say a word to anyone else about the matter. You can trust me.
Marco writes a toppling pile of boxes while he considers the matter. All right, he says. Though I must admit, Mr. Barris, I am surprised at how accepting you are of all this. Mr. Barris chuckles in response.
I admit that of the lot of us, I seem the least likely, he says. The world is a more interesting place than I had ever imagined when I came to that first midnight dinner. Is that because Miss Bowen can animate a solid wooden creature on a carousel? Or because you could manipulate my memory? Or because the circus itself pushed the boundaries of what I dreamed was possible, even before I entertained the thought of actual magic? I cannot say, but I would not trade it for anything.
And you will keep my identity from Miss Bowen?
I shall not tell her, Mr. Barris says. You have my word.
In that case, Marco says, I would appreciate your assistance with something. When the letter arrives, Mr. Barris fears for a moment that Miss Bowen will be upset with the turn of events, or inquire as to who her opponent is, as she will have easily figured out that he is now aware of that fact himself. But when he opens the envelope, the enclosed note reads only, "May I make additions to it?" He writes back to inform her that it has been specifically designed to be manipulated by either side, so she may add whatever she wishes. Celia walks through a hallway full of snow, sparkling flakes of it catching in her hair and clinging to the hem of her gown. She holds out her hand, smiling as the crystals dissolve over her skin. The hall is lined with doors, and she chooses the one at the very end, trailing a melting breath of snow behind her as she walks into a room where she must duck to avoid colliding with a cascade of books suspended from the ceiling, pages tumbling open in frozen waves. She reaches a hand out to brush over the paper, the entire room swaying gently as the motion passes from page to page. It takes her quite a while to locate another door, hidden in a shadowed corner, and she laughs when her boots sink into the powder-soft sand that fills the room beyond. Celia stands on a shimmering white desert, with a sparkling night sky stretching in every direction. The sense of space is so vast that she must put her hand out in front of her to find the wall hidden in the stars, and it is still a surprise when her fingers hit the solid surface. She feels her way around the star-speckled walls, searching the perimeter for another way out.
"This is abhorrent," her father's voice says, though she cannot see him in the dim light. "You are meant to be working separately, not in this debauched juxtaposition. I have warned you about collaborating. It is not the proper way to exhibit your skills."
Celia sighs. "I think it's quite clever," she says. "What better way to compete than within the same tent? And you cannot rightfully call it collaboration. How can I collaborate with someone whose identity I don't even know?" She only catches a glimpse of his face as he glares at her, and then she turns away, returning her attention to the wall.
"Which is superior, then?" she asks.
"A room full of trees or a room filled with sand? Do you even know which ones are mine?
This is getting tiring, Papa. My opponent clearly possesses comparable skills. How will you ever determine a winner?"
"That is not your concern,"
her father's voice hisses, closer to her ear than she would like.
"You are a disappointment. I expected better from you. You need to do more."
"Doing more is exhausting," Celia protests.
"I can only control so much." "It's not enough," her father says.
"When will it be enough?"
Celia asks. But there is no reply, and she stands alone amongst the stars. She sinks to the ground, picking up a handful of pearl-white sand and letting it fall slowly through her fingers. Alone in his flat, Marco constructs tiny rooms from scraps of paper, hallways and doors crafted from pages of books and bits of blueprints, pieces of wallpaper and fragments of letters. He composes chambers that lead into others that Celia has created, stairs that wind around her halls, leaving spaces open for her to respond.
The ticking of the clock. Vienna, January 1894. The office is large but looks smaller than it is due to the volume of its contents. While a great deal of its walls are composed of frosted glass, most of it is obscured by cabinets and shelves. The drafting table by the windows is all but hidden in the meticulously ordered chaos of papers and diagrams and blueprints. The bespectacled man seated behind it is almost invisible, blending in with his surroundings. The sound of his pencil scratching against paper is as methodical and precise as the ticking of the clock in the corner. There is a knock on the frosted glass door, and the scratching pencil halts, though the ticking clock pays no heed.
"Miss Burgess to see you, sir,"
an assistant calls from the open door.
"She says not to bother you if you are otherwise occupied."
"Not a bother at all," Mr. Barris says, placing his pencil down and rising from his seat.
"Please send her in."
The assistant moves from the doorway and is replaced by a young woman in a stylish lace-trimmed dress.
"Hello, Ethan," Tara Burgess says. "My apologies for dropping by unannounced."
"No apologies necessary, my dear Tara. You look lovely, as always,"
Mr. Barris says, kissing her on both cheeks.
"And you haven't aged a day," Tara says pointedly.
His smile wavers and he looks away, moving to close the door behind her.
"What brings you to Vienna?" he asks. "And where is your sister? I so rarely see the two of you apart." "Lainey is in Dublin with the circus,"
Tara says, turning her attention to the contents of the room.
I wasn't in the mood, so I thought I would do some travelling on my own. Visiting far-flung friends seemed a good place to start. I would have sent a telegram, but it was all a bit spontaneous. And I wasn't entirely sure if I would be welcome."
"You are always welcome, Tara,"
Mr. Barris says. He offers her a seat,
but she does not notice, drifting through the tables covered in highly detailed models of buildings, stopping here and there to investigate a detail further, the arch of a doorway, the spiral of a staircase.
It becomes difficult to tell the difference between old friends and business associates in cases like ours, I think, Tara says. Whether we are the kind of people who make polite conversation to cover shared secrets, or something more than that. This one is marvelous, she adds, pausing at a model of an elaborate open column with a clock suspended in the center.
Thank you, Mr. Barris says. It's quite far from completion. I need to send the finished plans to Friedrich so he can start construction on the clock. I suspect it will be much more impressive when built to scale.
Do you have the plans for the circus here? Tara asks, looking over the diagrams pinned to the walls.
No, I don't, actually. I left them with Marco in London. I meant to keep copies on file, but I must have forgotten.
Did you forget to keep copies of any of your other plans?
Tara asks, running a finger along the line of cabinets fitted with long, thin shelves, each one piled with carefully ordered papers.
No, Mr. Barris says. Do you find that strange?
Tara asks.
Not particularly, Mr. Barris says. Do you think it's strange?
I think a great many things about the circus strange, Tara says, fidgeting with the lace at the cuff of her sleeve.
Mr. Barris sits at his desk, leaning back in his chair.
Are we going to discuss whatever it is you are here to discuss instead of dancing around it? He asks. I was never a particularly good dancer.
I knew for a fact that is not true, Tara says, settling into the chair opposite, though her gaze continues to wander around the room. But it would be nice to be direct for a change. I sometimes wonder if any of us remember how.
Why did you leave London?
I suspect I left London for much the same reasons that you and your sister travel so often, Mr. Barris says. A few too many curious looks and backhanded compliments. I doubt anyone realized that the day my hair stopped thinning was the same as the opening night of the circus. But they did begin to notice after a time. While our tante Padva might simply be aging well, and anything and everything about Chandrish can be written off as eccentric, we are put under a different kind of scrutiny by being somewhat closer to ordinary.
It is easier for those who can simply disappear into the circus, Tara says, gazing out the window.
Once in a while, Lainey suggests that we follow it around ourselves, but I think that would only be a temporary solution. We are too mercurial for our own good.
You could just let it go,
Mr. Barris says quietly. Tara shakes her head.
How many years until moving cities becomes insufficient? What is the solution beyond that? Changing our names? I do not enjoy being forced into such deceptions.
I don't know, Mr. Barris says.
There is a great deal more going on than we are privy to. Of that I'm quite sure,
Tara says with a sigh.
I tried to talk to Chandrish, but it was like we were speaking two different languages. I do not like sitting idly by when something clearly isn't right. I feel not trapped, but something like it, and I don't know what to do about it.
And you are looking for answers, Mr. Barris says.
I don't know what I'm looking for, Tara responds,
and for a moment her face crumples as though she might burst into tears, but then she composes herself.
Ethan, do you sometimes feel like you are dreaming all the time?
No, I can't say that I do.
I am finding it difficult to discern between asleep and awake, Tara says, tugging at her lace cuffs again. I do not like being left in the dark. I'm not particularly fond of believing in impossible things.
Mr. Barris takes off his spectacles, wiping the lenses with a handkerchief before he replies, holding them up to the light to check for rogue smudges.
I have seen a great many things that I might once have considered impossible or unbelievable. I find I no longer have clearly defined parameters for such matters. I choose to do my work to the best of my own abilities and leave others to their own.
He pulls open a drawer of the desk, and after searching for a moment, he takes out a business card that contains only a single name. Even looking at it upside down, Tara can easily discern the A and the H, if nothing else. Mr. Barris picks up a pencil and writes a London address beneath the printed name.
I don't think any of us knew that night precisely what we were getting ourselves into, he says. If you insist on delving deeper into all of this, I think he might be the only one of us that may help, though I cannot guarantee that he will be entirely forthcoming.
He slides the card across the desk to Tara. She regards it carefully before slipping it into her bag, as though she is not entirely sure it is real.
Thank you, Ethan, she says without looking at him. I appreciate this, truly. You're welcome, my dear, Mr. Barris says. I hope you find what you are looking for.
Tara only nods distractedly, and then they discuss other matters of little import, while the clock ticks through the afternoon hours, and the light beyond the frosted glass windows fades considerably. Though he asks her to join him for dinner, she declines politely and leaves alone. Mr. Barris returns to his drafting table, scratching pencil and ticking clock in harmony once more. The Magician's Umbrella, Prague, March 1894. The sign upon the gates of Le Cirque des Rêves tonight is a large one, hung with braided ribbon that wraps around the bars just above the lock. The letters are tall enough to be read from some ways off, though people still walk right up to it to read it. Closed due to inclement weather, it says, in a fancy script surrounded by playfully painted grey clouds. People read the sign sometimes twice, and then look at the setting sun and the clear violet sky and scratch their heads. They stand around and some wait to see if the sign will be removed and the circus opened. But there is no one in sight, and eventually the small crowd disperses to find alternative activities for their evening. An hour later, it starts, sheets of rain pouring down and wind that ripples across the surface of the striped tents. The sign on the gates dances in the wind, shimmering and wet. At the other end of the circus, at a part of the fence that looks nothing like a gate, but opens nonetheless, Celia Bowen steps out from the shadows of darkened tents and into the rain, opening her umbrella with some difficulty. It is a large umbrella, with a heavy curved handle, and once Celia manages to get it open, it provides quite good cover against the rain, though the lower half of her wine-colored gown is quickly soaked to the point where it appears almost black. She walks without much notice into the city, though there is not much notice to attract in such a downpour. She passes only a handful of other pedestrians on the cobblestone streets, each partially hidden beneath an umbrella. Eventually, Celia stops at a brightly lit cafe, crowded and lively despite the weather. She adds her umbrella to the collection gathering in the stands by the door. There are a few unoccupied tables, but the empty chair that catches Celia's eye is one by the fireplace across from Isabel, where she sits with a cup of tea and her nose buried in a book. Celia has never been entirely certain what to make of the fortune teller, though she has an innate distrust of anyone whose occupation involves telling people what they wish to hear, and Isabel sometimes has the same look in her eye Celia often catches in Tsukiko's glances, that she knows more than she lets on. Though perhaps that is not unusual for someone in the business of telling other people what their future holds. May I join you? Celia asks. Isabel looks up, the surprise clear in her expression, but the surprise is quickly replaced by a bright smile. Of course, Isabel says, marking her page before placing her book aside. I can't believe you ventured out in the weather. I only just missed the start of it earlier, and I thought I'd wait it out. I was meant to be meeting someone, but I don't think they'll be coming, considering. I can't blame them, Celia says, pulling off her damp gloves. She shakes them gently, and they dry instantly.
It's rather like walking through a river out there.
Are you avoiding the inclement weather party?
I made an appearance before I escaped. I am not in a party mood this evening. Besides, I don't like giving up an opportunity to leave the circus for a change of atmosphere, even if it means practically drowning to do so.
I like to escape once in a while myself, Isabel says.
Did you make it rain to have a night off?
Of course not, Celia says. Though if that were true, I think I overdid it.
Even as she speaks, Celia's rain-soaked gown is drying, the almost black color returning to a rich wine. Though it is not entirely clear whether this is caused by the nearby fire burning merrily, or if it is a subtle transformation she is performing herself. Celia and Isabel chat about the weather and Prague and books, not purposely avoiding the topic of the circus, but keeping the distance from it alive. Remaining for the moment, only two women sitting at a table, rather than a fortune teller and an illusionist, an opportunity they are not frequently presented with. The door of the café blows open, sending a gust of rain-spiked wind inside that is met with howls of annoyance from the patrons and the clattering of the umbrellas in their stands. A harried-looking waitress pauses at their table, and Celia requests a mint tea. As the waitress departs, Celia casts a long look around the room, scanning the crowd as though she is looking for someone, but not finding a point to focus on.
"Is something the matter?" Isabel asks.
"Oh, it's nothing," Celia says, a hint of feeling that we're being watched. "But it is likely just my imagination."
"Maybe someone has recognized you," Isabel suggests.
"I doubt that," Celia says as she looks at the surrounding patrons, not finding a single eye turned in their direction. "People see what they want to see. I'm sure this place has had more than its share of unusual patrons with the circus in town. That makes it easier for us to blend in."
"I'm always amazed that no one recognizes me out of context," Isabel says. "I've read for a handful of people in this very room over the past few nights, and not one of them has so much as given me a second glance. Perhaps I do not look so mysterious when not surrounded by candles and velvet. Or perhaps they pay more attention to the cards than they do to me."
"Do you have your cards with you?" Celia asks. Isabel nods.
Would you like a reading?" she asks.
"If you do not mind."
"Not once have you ever asked me to read for you."
"I'm not usually in the mood to know anything about my future," Celia says. "Tonight, I'm feeling a tiny bit curious."
Isabel hesitates, glancing around at the clientele, a mostly bohemian crowd sipping absinthe and arguing about art.
"They will not even notice," Celia says. "I promise."
Isabel turns her attention back to Celia, and then she pulls a deck from her bag. Not her black and white circus cards, but her original Marseille deck, worn and faded.
"Those are lovely,"
Celia says as Isabel starts to shuffle, watching the shifting blur of cards.
"Thank you."
"But there are only 77 of them."
Isabel's hands falter only momentarily, but a single card falls from the deck onto the table. Celia picks it up, briefly glancing at the two cups upon the surface, before handing it back to Isabel, who replaces it in the deck and resumes shuffling, the cards falling seamlessly from one hand to the other.
"One of them is somewhere else," Isabel explains.
Celia does not question her further. The waitress brings Celia's mint tea, not even glancing at the cards before departing again.
"Did you do that?" Isabel asks.
"I diverted her attention, yes,"
Celia says, after blowing gently on the surface of her steaming tea. It is not exactly what she means, but the invisible veil she has drawn over the table seems too difficult to explain, and the fact that the feeling they are being watched has not faded despite its presence bothers her. Isabel stops shuffling and places the deck face down on the table. Celia cuts the deck in three without waiting for Isabel to instruct her, holding the edges of the cards carefully as she places each pile in a row across the table.
"Which one?"
Isabel asks. Celia regards the three piles of cards thoughtfully while she sips her tea. After a moment, she indicates the center pile. Isabel stacks the deck once more, keeping that section of cards on the top. The cards that she places on the table have no immediate clarity to them. Several cups, the two of swords, La Papessa, the enigmatic priestess. Isabel only barely manages to contain her involuntary intake of breath as she lays Le Bateleur over the already placed cards. She covers it with a cough. Celia appears not to notice anything amiss.
I'm sorry,
Isabel says, after staring silently at the cards for a few moments.
Sometimes it takes a while for me to translate properly.
Take your time, Celia says. Isabel pushes the cards around the table, focusing on one and then another.
You carry a great many burdens with you, a heavy heart, things you've lost. But you are moving toward change and discovery. There are outside influences that are propelling you forward.
Celia's expression reveals nothing. She looks at the cards and occasionally up at Isabel, attentive yet guarded.
You're not fighting. That's not really the right word for it, but there's a conflict with something unseen, something shadowed that's hidden from you.
Celia only smiles. Isabel places another card on the table.
But it will be revealed soon, she says.
This catches Celia's attention.
How soon? The cards do not make for the clearest of timelines, but it is very close, almost immediate, I would think.
Isabel pulls another card, the Two of Cups again.
There's emotion, she says, deep emotion. But you are only on the shore of it, still near the surface, while it is waiting to pull you under.
Interesting, Celia remarks.
It's nothing that I can clearly see as good or bad, but it is intense.
Isabel pushes the cards around a bit. Le Bateleur and La Papessa, surrounded by fire-tinged wands and watery cups. The crackle of the fire next to them mingles with the rain pattering against the windows.
It almost contradicts itself, she says after a moment. It's as if there is love and loss at the same time, together in a kind of beautiful pain.
Well, that sounds like something to look forward to, Celia says dryly. And Isabel smiles, glancing up from the cards, but finding little to read in Celia's expression.
I'm sorry I cannot be more clear, she says. If anything comes to me later, I will let you know. Sometimes I need to ruminate on the cards before I can make any real sense of them. These are not unclear, precisely, but they are complex, which makes for a great deal of possibilities to consider.
No need for apologies. I cannot say I'm terribly surprised, and thank you. I very much appreciate the insight. Celia changes the subject then, though the cards remain on the table, and Isabel does not move to put them away. They discuss less substantial matters until Celia insists that she should be getting back to the circus.
Do wait until the rain lets up at least, Isabel protests.
I have monopolized enough of your time already, and the rain is only rain. I hope that someone you were waiting for turns up.
I'm doubtful about that, but thank you. And thank you for keeping me company.
It was my pleasure, Celia says, rising from the table as she replaces her gloves. She navigates the crowded cafe with ease, pulling a dark-handled umbrella from the stand by the door and giving Isabel a parting wave before bracing herself for the walk back to the circus in the pouring rain. Isabel pushes the tangled path of the cards on the table around a bit. She did not lie, exactly. She finds it near impossible to lie about the cards. But the competition is clear, so much so that everything else is tied to it, past and future. At the same time, it seems to be more of a reading for the circus as a whole than for Celia in particular. But it is so emotional that it overwhelms the details. Isabel piles the cards and shuffles them back into the deck. Le Bateleur floats to the top as she shuffles, and she frowns at the card before glancing around the cafe. While there are a few scattered bowler hats amongst the patrons, There is no sign of the one she is looking for. She shuffles until the magician is buried deep within the deck, and then she puts her cards away and returns to her book to wait out the rain alone. Outside, the rain is heavy, and the street is dark and almost completely deserted, glowing windows dotting the streets. It is not as cold as Celia had expected, despite the chilling wind. She cannot read the tarot well herself. There are always too many possibilities, too many meanings. But once Isabel pointed out specific elements, she could see the complicated emotion, the impending revelation. She is unsure what to make of it, though, despite her skepticism, she hopes it means she will finally be certain who her opponent is. She remains distracted as she walks, considering the cards, but she slowly realizes that she is rather warm. At least as warm, if not warmer, than she had been sitting near the fire with Isabel. More than that, her clothes are still dry. Her jacket, her gloves, even the hem of her gown. There is not a single drop of rain upon her, although it continues to pour. The wind causing the rain to fall in several directions beyond the standard gravitational pattern. Drops splatter upward from pond-like puddles and blow in sideways, but Celia does not feel any of them. Even her boots are not the slightest bit damp. Celia stops walking as she reaches the open square, halting next to the towering astronomical clock, where carved apostles are making their scheduled hourly appearance despite the weather. She stands still in the downpour. The rain falls so thickly around her that she can hardly see more than a few paces ahead, but she remains both warm and dry. She holds her hand out in front of her, beyond the cover of the umbrella, and regards it carefully, but not a single drop of rain falls upon it. Those that come close suddenly change direction before hitting her glove, bouncing off as though she is surrounded by something invisible and impermeable. It is around this time that Celia becomes certain that the umbrella she is holding is not her own.
"Excuse me, Miss Bowen,"
a voice calls to her, lifted over the din of the rain and carried down the street. A voice she recognizes even before she turns, to find Marco standing behind her, completely drenched in rain, droplets cascading from the brim of his bowler hat. In his hand he holds a closed black umbrella identical to the one she carries.
"I believe you have my umbrella," he says, almost out of breath, but wearing a grin that has too much wolf in it to be properly sheepish.
Celia stares up at him in surprise. At first she wonders what on earth Chandrish's assistant is doing in Prague, as she has never seen him outside of London. Then comes the question of how he could possess such an umbrella. As she stares at him, confused, the pieces of the puzzle begin to shift together. She remembers every encounter she has ever had with the man now standing before her in the rain, recalling the distress he had exhibited at her audition, the years of glances and comments she had read as no more than coy flirtation, and the constant impression as though he is not really there, blending so well into the background that she would occasionally forget he was in the room. Before, she thought it was the sign of a very good assistant, never accounting for how deceptive such an appearance might be. She suddenly feels rather stupid for not once considering the possibility that this could be her opponent. And then Celia begins to laugh, a buoyant giggle that harmonizes with the din of the rain. Marco's grin wavers as he watches her, blinking water from his eyes. Once Celia composes herself, she gives him a low, perfect curtsy. She hands him his umbrella, gasping as the rain seizes her the moment the handle passes from her fingers. He hands her the identical umbrella.
"My sincere apologies," she says, the amusement still sparkling in her eyes. "I would very much like to speak with you, if you care to join me for a drink," Marco says.
His bowler hat is already dry as he attempts in vain to cover both of them with the open umbrella. The wind whips Celia's dark curls in wet ropes across her face as she considers him, watching his eyes as the raindrops evaporate from his lashes. For all the years of wondering, being faced with her opponent, is not what she had expected. She had expected it to be someone she knew, someone inside the bounds of the circus rather than outside, but still involved. There are so many questions, so many things she longs to discuss, despite her father's constant nagging about not concerning herself with her opponent. But at the same time, she feels suddenly exposed, aware that he has always known where each of them stood, known every time he opened a door for her or took notes for Chandrish, every time he stared at her as he does now with those disconcertingly bright green eyes. Still, it is a tempting invitation. Perhaps if she was not nearly drowning from the rain, she would accept it. "Of course you would," Celia says, returning Marco's grin with one of her own. "Perhaps another time." She opens her own umbrella with some difficulty, and as she swings the canopy of black silk over her head, she and her umbrella vanish, leaving only drops of water falling onto the empty pavement. Alone in the rain, Marco regards the space where Celia had been standing for some time before he walks away into the night. Reflections and Distortions. The sign says Hall of Mirrors, but when you enter you find it is more than a simple hall. You are met not with floor-length unadorned planes of mirrored glass as you half expected, but hundreds of mirrors of varying sizes and shapes, each in a different frame. As you move past one mirror reflecting your boots, the mirror next to it shows only empty space and the mirrors on the other side. Your scarf is not present in one mirror, and then it returns in the next. Reflected behind you, there is a man in a bowler hat, though he appears in some mirrors and not in others. When you turn, you cannot locate him in the room, though there are more patrons walking along with you than you had seen within the glass. The hall leads to a round room, the light within it bright as you enter. It radiates from a tall lamppost that sits in the center, towering black iron with a frosted glass lamp that looks as though it would be more at home on a city street corner than in a circus tent. The walls here are completely mirrored, each long mirror placed to align with the striped ceiling visible above and the floor that is painted to match. As you walk farther into the room, it becomes a field of endless street lamps, the stripes repeating in fractal patterns over and over and over. Cartomancy. Concord, Massachusetts, October 1902. As he continues to walk around the circus, Bailey's path leads back to the courtyard. He stops briefly to watch the sparkling bonfire, and then at a vendor to purchase a bag of chocolates to make up for his mostly uneaten dinner. The chocolates are shaped like mice, with almond ears and licorice tails. He eats two immediately and puts the rest of the bag in the pocket of his coat, hoping they will not melt. He chooses another direction to leave the courtyard, circling away from the bonfire again. He passes several tents with interesting signs, but none that he feels compelled to enter just yet, still playing the illusionist performance over in his mind. As the path turns, he comes upon a smaller tent with a lovely elaborate sign, Fortune Teller. He can read that bit easily, but the rest is a complex swirl of intricate letters, and Bailey has to walk right up to it to read, Fates Foretold and Darkest Desires Disclosed. Bailey looks around. For a moment there is no one else in sight in either direction, and the circus feels eerily similar to the way it had when he snuck through the fence in the middle of the day, as though it is empty save for himself and the things and people that are always there. The ongoing argument about his own future echoes in his ears as he enters the tent. Bailey finds himself in a room that reminds him of his grandmother's parlor, only smelling less like lavender. There are seats, but all of them are unoccupied, and a sparkling chandelier captures Bailey's attention for a moment before he notices the curtain. It is made up of strings of shiny beads. Bailey has never seen anything like it. It shimmers in the light, and he is not entirely sure whether he should walk through it or wait for some sort of sign or notice. He looks around for an informatively worded sign, but finds nothing. He stands confused in the empty vestibule, and then a voice calls out from behind the beaded curtain.
"Do come in, please,"
the voice says, a woman's voice, quiet, and sounding as though she is standing right next to him, though Bailey is sure that the voice came from the next room. Hesitantly, he puts a hand out to touch the beads, which are smooth and cold, and he finds that his arm slips through them easily, that they part like water or long grass. The beads clatter as the strands hit one another, and the sound that echoes in the dark space sounds like rain. The room he is in now is much less like his grandmother's parlor. It is filled with candles, and there is a table in the center, with an empty chair on one side, and a lady dressed in black, with a long thin veil over her face, seated on the other. On the table there is a deck of cards and a large glass sphere.
"Have a seat, please, young man," the lady says,
and Bailey walks a few steps to the empty chair and sits down. The chair is surprisingly comfortable, not like the stiff chairs at his grandmother's, though they do look remarkably similar. It only now strikes Bailey that, other than the red-haired girl, he has never heard any person in the circus speak. The illusionist was silent for her entire performance, though he had not noticed it at the time.
"I am afraid payment is required before we may begin," she says.
Bailey is relieved that he has excess pocket money for the unplanned expenses.
"How much is payment?" he asks. "Whatever you wish to pay for a glimpse of your future," the fortune teller says.
Bailey stops to consider this for a moment. It is strange, but fair. He pulls what he hopes is a suitable amount from his pocket and puts it on the table, and the woman does not pick the money up, but passes her hand over it, and it disappears.
"Now, what is it you would like to know?" she asks.
"About my future," Bailey says. "My grandmother wants me to go to Harvard, but my father wants me to take over the farm."
"And what do you want?"
the fortune teller asks.
"I don't know," Bailey says.
She laughs in response, but in a friendly way, and it makes Bailey feel more at ease, as though he is just talking to a regular person and not someone mysterious or magical.
"That's fine," she says. "We can see what the cards have to say about the matter."
The fortune teller picks up the deck and shuffles, shifting the cards from one hand to the other. They fold over and under each other in waves. Then she spreads them across the table in one fluid motion, forming an arc of identical black and white patterned card backs.
"Choose a single card," she says. "Take your time. This will be your card, the one that will represent you."
Bailey looks at the arc of cards and frowns. They all look the same. Slivers of pattern, some wider than the others, some not quite as evenly lined up as the rest. He looks back and forth, from end to end, and then one of them catches his eye. It is more hidden than the rest, almost completely covered by the card above it. Only the edge is visible. He reaches out for it, but hesitates just before his hand reaches it.
"I can touch it?" he asks.
He feels the same as when he was first allowed to set the table with the nicest dishes, as though he really shouldn't be allowed to touch such things, mixed with an acute fear of breaking something. But the fortune teller nods, and Bailey puts a finger on the card and pulls it away from its compatriots so it sits separately on the table.
"You may turn it over," the fortune teller says,
and Bailey flips the card. On the other side, it is not like the black and red playing card he is used to, with hearts and clubs and spades and diamonds. Instead, it is a picture, inked in black and white and shades of grey. The illustration is of a knight on horseback, like a knight from a fairy tale. His horse is white and his armour is grey. There are dark clouds in the background. The horse is in mid-gallop, the knight leaning forward in the saddle, with sword drawn as though he is on his way to a great battle of some sort. Bailey stares at the card, wondering where the knight is going and what the card is supposed to mean. Cavalier d'Epée, it reads in fancy script at the bottom of the card.
This is supposed to be me? Bailey asks.
The woman smiles as she pushes the arc of cards back into a neat pile.
It is meant to represent you in your reading, she says. It could mean movement or travel.
The cards do not always mean the same things every time. They change with each person.
That must make them hard to read, Bailey says.
The woman laughs again.
Sometimes, she says. Shall we give it a try anyway?
Bailey nods as she shuffles the cards again, over and under, and then divides them into three piles and places them in front of him, above the card with the knight.
Pick which pile you are most drawn to, she says.
Bailey studies the piles of cards. One is less neat, another larger than the other two. His eyes keep going back to the pile on the right.
This one, he says,
and though it is mostly a guess, it feels like the proper choice. The fortune teller nods and stacks the three piles of cards back into one deck, leaving Bailey's chosen cards on top. She flips them over, one at a time, laying them face up in an elaborate pattern across the table, some overlapping and others in rows, until there are about a dozen cards laid out. They are black and white pictures, much like the knight, some simpler, some more complicated. Many show people in various settings, and a few have animals, while some of them have cups or coins, and there are more swords. Their reflections catch and stretch in the crystal sphere that sits alongside. For a few moments, the fortune teller looks at the cards, and Bailey wonders if she is waiting for them to tell her something, and he thinks she is smiling, but trying to hide it just a bit.
This is interesting, the fortune teller says.
She touches one card, a lady in flowing robes holding a set of scales, and another that Bailey cannot see as well, but looks like a crumbling castle.
What's interesting?
Bailey asks, still confused about the process. He knows no ladies in blindfolds, has been to no crumbling castles. He's not even sure there are any castles in New England.
You have a journey ahead of you, the fortune teller says. There's a lot of movement, a great deal of responsibility.
She pushes one card, turns another around, and furrows her brow a bit, though Bailey still thinks she looks like she is trying to hide a smile. It is becoming easier to see her expression through her veil as his eyes adjust to the candlelight.
You are part of a chain of events, though you may not see how your actions will affect the outcome at the time.
I'm going to do something important, but I have to go somewhere first, Bailey asks. He had not expected fortune-telling to be so vague. The journey part does seem to favour his grandmother's side, though, even if Cambridge is not very far. The fortune-teller does not immediately respond. Instead, she flips over another card. This time she does not hide her smile.
You're looking for Poppet, she says.
What's a Poppet? He asks. The fortune-teller does not answer, and instead looks up from her cards and regards him quizzically. Bailey feels her taking in his entire appearance, or more than that, with her eyes moving over his face from his scarf to his hat. He shifts in his chair.
Is your name Bailey? She asks.
The colour drains from Bailey's cheeks, and all the apprehension and nervousness he had felt earlier returns instantly. He has to swallow before he can make himself answer, in barely more than a whisper.
Yes, he says.
It sounds like a question, as though he is not entirely sure that it is indeed his name. The fortune-teller smiles at him, a bright smile that makes him realize she is not nearly as old as he had previously thought, perhaps only a few years older than he is.
Interesting, she says.
He wishes she would choose a different word.
We have a mutual acquaintance, Bailey.
She looks back down at the cards on the table.
You are here this evening looking for her, I believe, though I do appreciate that you've chosen to visit my tent as well.
Bailey blinks at her, trying to take in everything she said, and wondering how on earth she knows the real reason he is at the circus when he has told no one about it and hardly even admits it to himself.
"You know the red-haired girl?" he says, unable to fully believe that this is indeed what the fortune-teller means. But she nods. "I have known her and her brother all their lives," she says. "She is a very special girl with very lovely hair."
Is she here still?" Bailey asks.
"I only met her once, the last time the circus was here."
"She is here," the fortune-teller says. She pushes the cards around on the table a bit more, touching one and then another, though Bailey is no longer paying attention to which card is which.
"You will see her again, Bailey. There's no doubt about that."
Bailey resists the urge to ask her when, and instead waits to see if she has anything else to add about the cards. The fortune-teller moves a card here and there. She picks up the card with the knight from where it sits and places it on top of the crumbling castle.
"Do you like the circus, Bailey?"
she asks, looking up at him again.
"It's like no place I've ever been," Bailey says.
"Not that I've been many places," he adds quickly.
"But I think the circus is wonderful. I like it very much."
"That would help," the fortune-teller says.
"Help with what?"
Bailey asks, but the fortune-teller does not answer. Instead, she flips over another card from the deck, placing it over the card with the knight. It is a picture of a lady pouring water into a lake, a bright shining star over her head. It is still difficult to discern her expressions through her veil, but Bailey is certain that she frowns at the card as she places it on the table, though when she looks back up at him, the frown is gone.
"You will be fine," the fortune-teller says. "There may be decisions to make and surprises in store. Life takes us to unexpected places sometimes. The future is never set in stone. Remember that."
"I will," Bailey says.
He thinks the fortune-teller looks a bit sad as she begins to gather up the cards on the table, putting them back into a neat pile. She saves the knight for last, placing him on the top of the deck.
"Thank you,"
Bailey says. He did not receive as clear an answer about his future as he had expected, but somehow the issue does not seem as heavy as it had before. He debates whether to leave, unsure of proper fortune-telling etiquette.
"You're welcome, Bailey," the fortune-teller says. "It was a pleasure to read for you."
Bailey reaches into his pocket and pulls out the bag of chocolate mice and offers it to her.
"Would you like a mouse?" he asks.
Before he can mentally berate himself for doing something so silly, the fortune-teller smiles, though for a moment there is something almost sad beneath it.
"Why, yes, I would," she says, pulling one of the chocolate mice out of the bag by its licorice tail.
She places it on the top of the crystal sphere.
"They're one of my favorites," she confides. "Thank you, Bailey. Enjoy the rest of your time at the circus."
"I will,"
Bailey says. He stands up and walks back to the beaded curtain. He reaches to part the strings of beads and stops suddenly and turns around.
"What's your name?"
he asks the fortune-teller.
"You know, I'm not sure any of my querents have ever asked that before," she says. "My name is Isabel."
"It was nice to meet you, Isabel," Bailey says.
"It was nice to meet you too, Bailey,"
Isabel says.
"And you might want to go down the path to your right when you leave," she adds.
Bailey nods and turns back, pushing through the strands of beads into the still empty vestibule. The beads are not so loud as they settle, and when they are quiet, everything is soft and still, as though there is no other room behind them, no fortune-teller sitting at her table. Bailey feels oddly at ease, as though he is closer to the ground, but taller at the same time. His concerns about his future no longer weigh so heavily on him as he exits the tent, turning right down the curving path that winds between the striped tents. The Wizard in the Tree. Barcelona, November 1894. The rooms hidden behind the multitude of tents in Le Cirque des Rêves are a stark contrast to the black and white of the circus, alive with color, warm with glowing amber lamps. The space kept by the Murray twins is particularly vivid, a kaleidoscope of color blazing with carmine and coral and canary, so much so that the entire room often appears to be on fire, dotted with fluffy kittens dark as soot and bright as sparks. It is occasionally suggested that the twins should be sent to boarding school to receive a proper education, but their parents insist that they learn more from living with such a diverse company and traveling the globe than they would confined by schoolrooms and books. The twins remain perfectly pleased with the arrangement, receiving irregular lessons on innumerable subjects and reading every book they can get their hands on, piles of them often ending up in the wrought-iron cradle they would not part with after it was outgrown. They know every inch of the circus, moving from color to black and white with ease, equally comfortable in both. Tonight they sit in a striped tent beneath a rather large tree, its branches black and bare of leaves. At this late hour there are no patrons lingering in this particular tent, and it is unlikely that any other visitors to the circus will stumble upon it in the remaining hours before dawn. The Murray twins lean against the massive trunk, sipping steaming cups of mulled cider. They have finished with their performance for the evening, and the remaining hours before dawn are theirs to spend as they please.
"Do you want to read tonight?"
Widget asks his sister.
"We could take a walk. It's not that cold."
He pulls a pocket watch from his coat to check the time.
"It's not that late yet, either,"
he adds, though their definition of late is what many would consider quite early. Poppet bites her lip in thought for a moment before answering.
"No," she says. "Last time everything was all red and confusing. I think maybe I should wait a bit before I try again."
"Red and confusing?"
Poppet nods.
"It was a bunch of things overlapping," she explains. "Fire and something red, but not at the same time. A man without a shadow. A feeling like everything was unraveling or tangling. The way the kittens pull yarn into knots and you can't find the beginning or the end anymore."
"Did you tell Celia about it?"
Widget asks.
"Not yet,"
Poppet says.
"I don't like to tell her things that don't make any sense. Most times things make sense eventually."
"That's true,"
Widget says.
"Oh, and another thing," Poppet says. "We're going to have company. That was in there somewhere too. I don't know if it was before or after the other things, or sometime in between."
"Can you see who it is?"
Widget asks.
"No,"
Poppet answers simply. Widget is not surprised.
"What was the red something?"
he asks.
"Could you tell?"
Poppet closes her eyes, remembering.
"It looks like paint,"
she says. Widget turns to look at her.
"Paint?"
he asks.
"Like spilled paint on the ground,"
Poppet answers. She closes her eyes again, but then opens them quickly.
"Dark red. It's all sort of jumbled, and I don't really like the red bit. When I saw it, it hurt my head. The company part is nicer."
"Company would be nice," Widget says.
"Do you know when?"
Poppet shakes her head.
"Some of it feels soon. The rest of it feels far away."
They sit quietly sipping their cider for a bit, leaning against the trunk of the tree.
"Tell me a story, please,"
Poppet says after a while.
"What kind of story?"
Widget asks. He always asks her, gives her an opportunity to make a request, even if he has one in mind already. Only preferred or special audiences receive such treatment.
"Story about a tree,"
Poppet says, looking up through the twisting black branches above them. Widget pauses before he starts, letting the tent and the trees settle into silent prologue, while Poppet waits patiently.
"Secrets have power,"
Widget begins,
"and that power diminishes when they are shared, so they are best kept and kept well. Sharing secrets, real secrets, important ones, with even one other person will change them. Writing them down is worse.
because who can tell how many eyes might see them inscribed on paper, no matter how careful you might be with them. So it's really best to keep your secrets when you have them, for their own good, as well as yours. This is, in part, why there is less magic in the world today. Magic is secret, and secrets